made a lot of bad moves. I know you could walk away, but you never do.
Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am here with Luke Ford for just one more show.
Hey, Robert.
How have you been?
Good, good.
So we're going to be discussing some of the same themes dealing with narcissism and addiction and eroticized rage. And you've been you linked to some of these articles from this this psychiatrist in Santa Barbara named Linda Hatch. One of them is five ways about sex addiction and narcissism.
Yeah, well, I'll take the first article that I was linking to on my blog. It's like five ways sex addiction recovery can get derailed. So first of all, what is addiction? Addiction simply means that the reward centers in your brain aren't working in your own benefit. So for instance, if you are endangering yourself because you're addicted to exercise, or if you are damaging your relationships with the people most important to you, or if you are getting fired from your jobs because you are so addicted to exercise, then you know, it's useful to use the term addiction. Or let's say you're so addicted to alcohol so that you're getting fired from jobs, it's costing you friends and relationships, your life has become unmanageable, then it's fair to say you might have an addiction to alcohol. In high school, I really got into gambling, and so I eventually ran up about a $1,200, $1,300 gambling debt to another student in my high school, and I didn't have that kind of money, so I was leaving the country to go to Australia for a year, so I paid him off about, $200, and he was okay with that, he accepted that, but I've never gambled again with my own money. I remember I once was in Vegas, and someone wanted to play the slot machines, and she gave me like $20 credit, and so I was able to just gamble with that $20 credit. But since high school, I've never gambled with my own money because I'm a gambling addict. Like in my teens, I had this sense that I had an addictive personality. I didn't fully understand what that meant. But what it meant to me at the time was that I absolutely had to avoid drugs and alcohol, because those were the only addictions that I really had much of a notion was, because this is the late 70s and early 1980s.
Have you ever gotten drunk in your entire life?
I had a couple of drinks on my high school graduation, and that's it. So there are many different types of addiction. Some people get high from spending money, and so debting and spending can be an addiction. And then sex is an addiction when you are chasing sex, fantasizing about sex, and pursuing sex in ways that are, say, illegal, getting you arrested, or if the way you're doing it is costing you your reputation in the community, if it's causing you to get fired from your work, if it is costing you friends and connections with your family, then your pursuit of sex could be called an addiction. I have something like I have a fantasy addiction. I've spent just way too much of my life just in dreams of a fantasy of, like, what would I do if I was the Prime Minister of Australia? What would I do if I was the President of the United States? What would I do if I was the editor of the New York Times? So it's called maladaptive daydreaming. That's, you know, when you just zone out and you just daydream for hours at a time in a way that doesn't enhance your life. So many of these addictions start out as adaptive. They help you get through difficult times. So I remember when I was about age 9, and I was my parents were busy, and they just wanted me to stay out of the way. And so I just kind of sat in a chair, and I just told myself stories for like 2 hours, and my parents were thrilled because I wasn't in the way. On the downside, I was developing this daydreaming addiction, which, you know, in the long run has not served me well, and I still can, you know, snap into it and just kind of daydream and waste my time. So
do you ever fluctuate back and forth between, like, daydreaming? Does ever, like, turn to fantasies of, say, dealing with, like, vengeance towards people who you perceive have wronged you?
Rarely. Probably more in the past, but these days I rarely dream about getting revenge on people. So, you know, I think I'm pretty much past that, but, you know, your fantasies can change and come back at any time, but that has not played much of a role in my life, in the last 3 years in particular. So, your question was about sex addiction recovery and five ways that, sex addiction recovery can get derailed. So what is sex addiction recovery? That's like the return of choice and dignity and sanity to your life, so that you're no longer acting out in ways that harm your life. And usually that'll involve a 12-step program, perhaps a treatment center and psychotherapy and some combination of those. But probably sex addiction, sex and love addiction, is probably the most difficult addiction to get over because it so permeates the addict's whole being. So there are probably five prominent ways in this essay by Dr. Linda Hatch that the sex addiction recovery can get derailed. And this also would apply to many other addictions, but way number one is incomplete disclosure. So that's where you don't tell someone about what your addiction was like, and say you keep quiet about hiring escorts or having gay sex or combining sex with cocaine or something that's particularly shameful, and you don't disclose it. So there's a 12-step saying, you're only as sick as your secrets. And to get a recovery, most people need to disclose what their life was like when they're in the grip of their addiction.
What is that like, being in a 12-step program and having to, for the people in the group, having to disclose stuff like that? Is there like a strong element of shame?
There's not a have to disclose. I mean, there's no one's going to mandate that you disclose anything in a 12-step meeting. You don't have to share if you don't want to. Your recovery depends upon disclosing to somebody, but that doesn't mean you need to disclose to the whole group. Most people in a 12-step context find that disclosing what they've been dealing with is a release from shame and guilt, because now they've gotten it out there and they're with other people who have similar struggles. So you're among friends, you're among fellow addicts, and so no one's going to judge you if you've gone on a slot-a-palooza that weekend.
What is recovery tourism?
Yeah, so that's where you go to some meetings, but you don't engage in a deep way. So it's easy to go to meetings. What's much more difficult is working a 12-step program. So, you know, just going to meetings doesn't necessarily demand much from you. And then another way that your recovery can get derailed is by thinking that your sexual addiction or love addiction is the fault of your partner. And if you simply got a new partner or you moved to a new place or got a new job, that would take care of the addiction. Another way is to derail your recovery is to ignore deeper issues. So perhaps you have an ADD problem, or perhaps you have overall lack of intimacy in your life, not just in your sex life, but in an inability to bond with other people. And then there's sometimes just a misdiagnosis of what's really going on with someone. And there's a focus on one or two symptoms and not going deep. So I like this five-way sex addiction recovery can get derailed, essay by Linda Hatch, and we'll link to it from this interview.
Do most addicts lack true intimacy skills and the ability to be nurturing and vulnerable?
Yeah. Most addicts have what's called dysregulation, or they lack secure attachment. So when you're securely attached, you genuinely want to reach out to other people, to help other people, and to connect and bond with people, and you're comfortable with intimacy. If you have an anxious attachment style like I do, it means you're anxious about relationships. You become hyperactivated when you see someone important to you walking away from you, or just you perceive them as backing off. If someone doesn't return your call, or someone doesn't make an appointment, or someone lets you down who's important to you, it becomes very, very upsetting. And then the other probably 20% of the population has what's called dismissive attachment, where they just don't see the importance of relationships, they don't see the importance of having friendships, and they don't see the importance of human emotions, and they just try to tamp all that stuff down because it's so painful, and instead concentrate on things like ideas or on work or on religion.
And we were talking about this on our last show we did about narcissism, but in 2000, your family had you go see a therapist. Was that the first time in your life that you've seen a therapist?
No, I started seeing a therapist in about 1991. And so what happened in 2000 is my family offered me a trip back to Australia if I would see the doctors of their choice. And I agreed. And one of the doctors was a psychiatrist. So that's a little different than just a therapist. This was to get a diagnosis. So I went to see the psychiatrist, and then she came back with the diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder.
So he said that you have poor identity integration and poor self-esteem, and that you're always looking for mirroring, which is called a narcissistic supply, and you're always looking for external validation of himself as a person.
Yeah, and that I need other people to tell me who I am. And because it's not possible for people to mirror me all the time, I get disappointed, and this can turn to envy. And so I tend to fluctuate between devaluing people such as the family and idealizing people such as Dennis Prager, that I tend to make unreasonable demands of people who are eventually driven to setting limits on me, and that I take this very badly. The psychiatrist said I needed 5 to 10 years of insight-oriented psychotherapy. And while Luke has a lot of therapy speak, because by this time I'd had about 15 months of therapy, I may not really understand the concepts involved. And it's difficult for me to continue with therapy that is too confrontational. So psychiatrist reported Luke will continue to do what he's doing to satisfy his needs till such times as the rewards are outweighed by the negative effects. Then he may do something about getting his life on track and getting therapy. So this diagnosis did send me back to therapy, and I've largely been in therapy since year 2000.
So in 2011, you read your masturbation diary to your therapist, filled with fantasies about being powerful and women sleeping with you to get ahead in Hollywood, and he basically said that sounds like eroticized rage.
Yeah, and I'd never heard the term eroticized rage, so I immediately went home and Googled the term, and there were just some great essays on the topic, and I strongly recommend it.
So you didn't coin the term?
No.
That term's kind of I thought it was sort of associated with you.
Well, it may be, because maybe I've written more on it than anyone else by this point, but that was the first time I heard of it. It was in 2011, and then I just went home and Googled it, and I thought, whoa, this is fascinating stuff, and it really spoke to me as soon as I heard the term. It's anger that's being sexualized. It's usually in reaction to some over-controlling opposite sex figure from childhood, and it definitely spoke to me. I realized that I did have a streak of hatred towards women in me, that my sexual desires were just shot filled with anger, and cruelty. And I realized, you know, perhaps I should get some help. Maybe, you know, maybe I am a sex addict. You know, prior to this, I never thought I was a sex addict. I had a girlfriend 5 years previous who said she was a love addict. And I was so fascinated by that term, I went and checked out a couple of books from the library, and I thought, you know, maybe I am a love addict. And I discussed with my therapist if I was a sex addict, but because I'd never, like, withdrawn from life to pursue my sex addiction, I'd never, like, you know, missed an appointment, never, you know, not shown up to synagogue or to work or to any kind of social commitment because I wanted to, you know, watch porn or pursue some illicit affair, I didn't think, and because I'd never been arrested or done anything illegal, I thought, you know, I'm not really a sex addict. But when I read about eroticized rage, I thought, oh, you know, maybe there's something to it. And I have a kind of a flexible approach to truth. To me, it was less important whether or not I was a sex addict or a love addict than whether going to a 12-step program for sex and love addiction would help me. And so I decided to just try a 12-step program. And from the first day that I walked into the room and I heard people's stories, I immediately could identify with so many of them. And then I thought, oh, you know, maybe I am a sex and love addict. And then I just kept going to meetings and developing a deeper understanding of sex and love addiction. So with sex and love addiction and with all sorts of addiction, there are degrees. Like for many people, say sex addiction leads to illegal behavior. For plenty of other people, such as myself, there was never a point of crossing the line to do something illegal. So there are degrees of addiction. So, you know, there was never a time when I blew off work so that I could, you know, watch porn. There was never a time when I even blew off a social engagement or any kind of commitment so that I could, you know, watch porn or act out sexually. So in that sense, my addiction was not nearly as severe as many people, but still thinking about sex, fantasizing about sex was taking up, you know, way too much space in my life. And I was driven, you know, way too much by kind of an out of control, though still legal, you know, voracious sexual appetite. And I realized through the program that that just going to these meetings was having a sobering effect on me. That was already starting to change my sexual fantasies into something, you know, a little more civilized and gentle. And then starting to work the program, I managed to gain a release from all the people, places, and things that I that so resented, so that my life was no longer driven by so much unnecessary anger and resentment.
Can eroticized rage lead people towards, like, towards violence?
Well, sure. It's anger that's being sexualized, so rage can lead to violence. Rage can lead to assault and battery and rape and murder and torture, and, you know, rage can lead to all sorts of things. So I did have a bit of a rage problem, and though I was never in danger of crossing the line into illegal behavior, it was still, there was just too much rage for my own good and for the good of people who are close to me. So, you know, eroticized rage can lead to very nasty ends, but it doesn't necessarily do that for everyone. There are degrees of eroticized rage. And, you know, for instance, me, I've never been tempted to towards children. I'm not sexually attracted to children. I'm not tempted to commit rape and sex crimes. I always set a boundary that I wouldn't commit adultery. I just thought that was wrong, that I wouldn't, you know, take someone's girlfriend. So I had, you know, certain limits, but outside of those limits, I kind of let my nasty side reign free when I had a consenting partner. But even when you have a consenting partner and you're playing a lot of sex games and you're building up the intensity, that on the one hand, it seems like it could be like a healthy outlet. On the other hand, if you're just stoking the eroticized rage, that may not serve you. So if you're feeding and healthy parts of your psyche, it may be a good idea to try to get some sobriety in that respect.
And when you quit writing on porn professionally, you got into porn addiction for a while, and I'm reading this off the transcript from your play Eroticized Rage, but you wrote, there's so many free porn videos online out there, it's beyond my control. When they show the bukkake in all its full glory, the girls spilling out of their sailor suits, the 18-year-old gang, 18-year-old bukkake gangbangs.
Oh boy, did I write all that?
Yeah. You're kind of embarrassed now.
Yeah. When I quit writing on the industry, then it was easier for me to, you know, view porn as a drug and as a commodity. When I was writing on the industry, porn was kind of repellent to me because I was so much in the belly of the beast that the actual product had very little hold over me. But when I quit writing on the industry, when I quit relating to porn as a subject that I wrote about, then there were times when it would have this hold over me. And I decided I wouldn't fight it. I'd just roll with it, because within a week or two, usually I'd get disgusted. And then, you know, I'd back away from it for a few months. And then again, another bout would roll over me for a week or two, and I'd get disgusted and back away from it for a few months. And then I got into a 12-step program, and thank God my bottom lines are no masturbation, no pornography, and no sex outside of a committed relationship. So the benefits of this program is that I don't think about sex nearly as much. I'm not storing up eroticized rage scenarios as I go throughout the day that I can, you know, then work off at night. I probably think about sex, you know, one third, one quarter as much as I used to before I started working the program. So let's say in 2009, you know, I may well have been thinking about sex 2-3 hours a day. So today is probably less than 20 minutes a day on average. So that frees up my life and my psyche and my thinking and my feeling towards much healthier things.
What was the background story behind that article by Amy Klein in the New York Times? I think, did you write like an article called The Hitchhiker's Guide to Amy Klein?
Yeah, I read a lot of articles about Amy Klein, and she was the managing editor of the Jewish Journal. She also wrote a singles column, so it was just kind of a fun thing to write about. I'd read her column and then I'd dissect it. But she found it, I don't know, she didn't really enjoy it. She would tell people, "Oh, he's mostly harmless." But you know, obviously, I never followed her anywhere. I never stalked her. I never, you know, I don't know where she lived. I had no interest in ever engaging any, you know, unethical or illegal behavior. But I did write about her as a recurring theme on my blog, and then she turned about as fair play. So then she wrote about the experience of what it was like to be written about in a modern love column for the New York Times.
Did you have a crush on her, or you're just fascinated with her?
I don't think it was either. It was just, you know, sometimes it helps when you're blogging to not think too deeply about what you're doing. And so she was just an easy person to write about because she wrote a singles column for the Jewish Journal, and because she was, you know, definitely on the left in politics, and it was just an easy person to write about, who was herself writing about herself and was in a public position. So it's not like I'm picking on some clerk for Ralph's Grocery. You know, this was the managing editor of the Jewish Journal, who had, you know, considerable resources, and you know, it wasn't like I was picking on someone who was weak and defenseless. Also, I think I would read many of her articles and just get angry, and so I would just write. So no, I don't think I ever had either a crush or a deep fascination. It was just like more of a visceral response that I was irritated by many of the things that she wrote, but I also liked some of the things that she wrote. And so, you know, when you're feeling, I was blogging professionally then, meaning I made my living from blogging. And so that there's a tremendous demand just to like keep pouring out, you know, compelling content about, you know, real people that your readers can relate to and are interested in. And so I would just use people, places, and things just to try to get any inspiration for a blog post, because I was like churning out, you know, 10, 20 blog posts a day sometimes.
Are there things you've written in your blog in rage that you have later regretted writing?
Oh, certainly. And reading Amy Klein's Modern Love column kind of helped me to understand better how the effect of my writing on my subjects. So I think people would find a different tone in my writing, a more gentlemanly attitude in many respects. And as I've gone back through my blog, I've sometimes found things that I've removed that I thought were rude and crude and unnecessary. And so, yeah, I think there was a lot more anger in my old blogging than in my blogging over the past 3 years.
Well, you write now. You write a lot about like racial politics. Do you think there are people who are involved in that kind of racial politics who use that as a mechanism to channel like their personal rage, whether it's eroticized rage or just like a generic rage?
I think it's more the other. I think people have so many strong feelings about race that they're not allowed to express, that it then gets sublimated into other things. So I think much like the political disputes are just ways of acting out racial rage in a socially acceptable way. So yeah, I think many of the race warriors out there do seem you know, frequently like losers. They frequently seem scary people with psychological issues. But I think much more is the case that race is such a compelling topic that you're not allowed to express an opinion on except within very narrow boundaries. And so that frustration and rage and obsession with race that is natural, I think that, you know, almost everyone notices people who are different from him and feels more comfortable with people who are genetically similar to himself. That then gets dispersed in all sorts of weird sublimated ways. And Steve Saylor is probably the master of pointing this out. And people check out Steve Saylor's work, S-A-I-L-E-R. He's the master of pointing out how avoidance of the race matter just leads to stupidity.
Didn't Sigmund Freud have a theory that like he blamed a certain the Freudian analysis is blaming like certain political things on sexual repression? Are you familiar with that theory of Freudian psychology?
Yeah, and Kevin MacDonald does just a great job pointing out that there's just no scientific basis for psychoanalysis, which was founded by Sigmund Freud. It was overwhelmingly a school developed by secular Jews who had contempt for Western civilization. And this was a way of diagnosing the sickness of Western civilization. But there's no empirical evidence for the validity of psychoanalysis, as opposed to the validity of psychotherapy and cognitive behavioral therapy, for which, you know, we do have a great body of evidence. But psychoanalysis is just a lot of nonsense.
So the other article by Linda Hatch is Narcissists Watch More Porn Enter Eroticized Rage. And for a narcissist, a sex addict, compulsively seeking out pornography on the internet does a lot more than just providing sexual arousal and gratification.
Yeah, so she draws distinctions between different types of narcissists, and like the truest narcissist, we don't see an increase in their consumption of porn, but for other types of narcissists, we do see a dramatic increase. So sexual narcissists, we do see a dramatic increase in their consumption of porn when compared to the average population. So most sex addicts in treatment seem to be narcissistic, but it's not usually the pathological deep-rooted narcissism that borders on sociopathy. In reality, this narcissism is pretty much skin deep. They project feelings of grandiosity and self-importance as though they have a high opinion of themselves, but this is very, very shallow. And so the slightest, you know, criticism will, you know, just reduce them to helpless rage and self-hatred, which I think has pretty much been my story. So when you're dealing with a lot of rage and anger and fear and frustration with your life, you can learn to channel it and try to express it, you know, through sex and through use of porn. And so if early on in your life, the emotions of fear, risk, pain, and anger, they can serve as neurochemical escalators in regard to sex. So it's easy to start linking strong emotions to sexual arousals and then getting to a whole pattern of sexual arousal, sexual acting out, then the feeling of shame, and then wanting to get rid of the shame. So for me, the use of pornography or sex in my life was often the best escape or the easiest escape from a narcissistic wound. If I was dealing with a setback at work, with a very telling criticism, a social failure, a relationship failure, that the use of pornography or sex or emotional intrigue, romantic intrigue, or, you know, just having a relationship, it would kind of restore a feeling of parity. You know, where real life had dragged me down, then through the use of porn or sex, it kind of would restore me so that I would feel strong again. And, you know, porn girls, they're always there for you. You know, they're always freely available on the internet. Also gives you a feeling of getting even. You know, if you feel one down in life, if you feel frustrated and beaten and humiliated by the results of your day, then pornography is a way to kind of turn the tables in your mind, in your fantasy, and you may be particularly attracted to pornography of revenge and humiliation. Use of pornography can also be a defiance of convention say a religious community or a religious upbringing or a, you know, very religious parent. Use of pornography can be an acting out against that. And I think for me, I think the main thing it would do would just restore my sense of equilibrium. It would kind of restore my narcissistic false self, that, you know, this false self that I was a great man, that I was, you know, a very powerful man, even though in daily life I was kind of a loser. Through the use of pornography and use of fantasy, use of romantic intrigue, and through the use of sex, I would be able to escape into this narcissistic grandeur that, you know, I was this amazing person. But the more you do it, the more you get addicted to using these tricks to deal with your brokenness, to deal with your failures in life. And so what may start out as an adaptive coping mechanism quickly becomes maladaptive, and it increases your failures and frustrations in real life. And that's the point when many people start to look to get help.
Linda Hatch, she said she had a client, and he would hang out around coffee shops and look at attractive young women, and then he would realize that he could not have those women, so he would go home and and go on a marathon of pornography use, and he particularly liked the fact that that these women were always there for him. But what she's saying is that the scenario depicted in online porn images and videos has the power to change feelings of being down or undesirable, and makes them feel the exact opposite. Restores the person's sense of self-worth.
Yeah, well, pornography or just movies and television in general, they're a solve for the inherent frustrations of life. Like, almost every guy has the experience of being turned down for a date, you know, hundreds of times by attractive women, or just being ignored by attractive women that the hottest women in high school or college didn't even take him seriously. But, you know, when he turns on the pornography, then he can imagine that, you know, he is making it with that high school cheerleader who rejected him in real life, that he is making it with the haughty teacher who was just so damn hot, or he is making it with, you know, the hot chicks at Starbucks. And so it's a way that people who are losers in real life can feel, you know, even if it's only for a few minutes, like a winner. So pornography is, you know, overwhelmingly the fuel for losers to help them get through life. It's overwhelmingly the fuel used by people who are lonely, people who are broken, people who are unable to cope successfully and triumphantly with real life, and so they retreat into fantasy, into addiction, and into pornography.
And so when they go on a porn marathon, they at first get a high, but when they're done looking at porn, what happens is that basically the high that they get from that porn use, does it end immediately after they stop looking at the porn?
Yeah, well, I think any guy who's had an orgasm knows the, you know, tremendous state change that occurs between, you know, the end of the orgasm and, you know, 10 seconds later, you're just completely deflated and, you know, somewhat sleepy, and you know, all your compulsions have kind of disappeared. So you're in a completely different state. So, you know, I don't know that most people who use pornography are then filled with self-hate. You know, I think some people are, but many people are not. It's just kind of the sating of a desire, just like people who are food addicts. If they get their stomach full, it reduces their anxiety because the blood rushes to the stomach. And so they just kind of feel sated and full, and the anxiety goes away. So it's probably something similar for the typical pornography addict or just sex addict.
So the porn addicts, do they get a sense of they feel powerful if they watch, like, say, the porn actress being, like, humiliated?
Yeah, I think I think almost every guy has experienced a lot of humiliation at the hands of women. You know, often at the hands of his mother, and so this is a way to get back at that. And then also many will graduate to using hookers. So knowing that I had an addictive personality, I'd never sought out the services of a hooker. I've never paid for a lap dance or for a hooker in my life, because, you know, I knew that I'd find it addictive. And that, you know, I'd just kind of be off to the races, and it would be all I'd be thinking about is, you know, how can I get more money to pay for another hooker? And
so you've never been in a strip club?
I've been in a strip club, but I've never bought a lap dance. I've never bought sex. I've never gone to a strip club for my own entertainment. I went when I was covering something for my blog. So I don't like strip clubs. They're very depressing.
Did you find the porn industry overall depressing?
Oh yeah, it's a very depressing industry. The outstanding characteristic of the porn industry is overwhelmingly people who lack bonds to other people. Like, if you're tightly bonded to your family, you're unlikely to get into the porn industry because you would not want to cause them shame. If you're tightly bonded to a religion or to an ethnic community or to friends, again, you're unlikely to get into the pornography industry because it would cause the people who love you too much shame. So overwhelmingly, the people who are in it lack emotional ties, lack bonds, lack attachment to other people. And so you know, the kind of sad, lonely cases, you know, often sex and love addicts or drug addicts or alcoholics or just, you know, basically they're all hookers or pimps. And so, yeah, it's a pretty dark corner of reality.
Do you think someone who gets into making, like, extreme porn, like, say, like, Max Hardcore, do you think someone like that has rage? Do you think someone like that has, like, personal rage that they want to act out, or they're just doing it for the profits?
Yeah, I think probably the odds are pretty good that they have rage that they want to act out. But I'm sure, you know, that you and I and almost everyone listening to this has rage that they would like to act out. So, you know, I'm not sure that the people who make humiliation pornography are that much more twisted than the people who are listening to this podcast right now.
Have you interviewed him?
Yeah, I know Max Hardcore pretty well, and he's an interesting character. On the one hand, he's very polite when he's sober, and on the other, he really has his finger on the pulse of, you know, what makes for good hardcore pornography, which is humiliation.
Didn't he end up going? I think he ended up going to prison for some of his stuff.
Yeah, I think so too, but. I quit writing on the industry in 2007. I haven't kept up with it. I have no friends in the industry that I've kept up with. There's no one that I've stayed in touch with, you know, even once a year. And I'm gone. But I just looked him up on Wikipedia, and I think they're using a photo of Max that I took. And yeah, it says that he spent 2.5 years in prison. For obscenity.
So, this other article about narcissism, I guess it's slightly different than what we were talking about, but narcissism and humor, and it's another Sam Bakhtin video.
Yeah.
And it says a narcissist rarely engages in a self-deprecating humor. But you have a narcissistic personality disorder, and you engage in self-deprecating humor all the time.
Yeah, well, here's an example. Max Hardcore stated in a February 2012 interview that he wants to do good in the world. This is after his release from prison, and so he's gone back into the porn industry. So for the narcissist, whether it comes to humor or religion or work or blogging, whatever it is, the main agenda is that they're an attention-seeking missile. So, you know, the narcissist may have a sense of humor, but he will usually expect to be praised for it. He will usually expect to, you know, receive attention and adulation for it. And just like with everything that the narcissist does, he is in a terminal pursuit of narcissistic supply, to use the words of Sam Bakhtin. And it's not like it's hopeless for narcissists. There are ways to get a significant degree of recovery. 12-step program can be a big help, and psychotherapy can be a big help, and having a spiritual or religious change can be a big help. But yeah, normally narcissistic people are kind of pompous. And they're the most easy people in the world to manipulate, because all you have to do is give them a little bit of praise and you have their undivided attention. Or if you give them a little bit of criticism, they're typically, you know, devastated. So a narcissist is very easy to manipulate.
Could you have someone who is a narcissist internally and psychologically, but at the same time their outer personality comes across as very meek, and they're not able to express themselves. They have trouble expressing that to other people.
Well, if they're narcissistic, they're going to be attention seeking. You know, even if their personality is meek, it will be meek in a manipulative, attention seeking way. So, if they're genuinely meek, they're not going to be narcissistic. They're going to be, you know, recovered from their narcissism if they ever had it. So a narcissist is really easy to spot. know, it's just, it's all about them and more attention for them. So if it, you know, if someone's narcissism doesn't jump out at you, then they're probably not NPD, narcissistic personality disorder. So usually narcissists are very easy to spot.
Would you say comedians tend to be narcissists?
No, because they have to be so in touch with reality to be genuinely funny. So I wouldn't expect that someone who's working and making a living at it would be genuinely narcissistic personality disorder. They may, you know, definitely have some narcissistic trends or traces, but I wouldn't expect them to have a disabling narcissism.
Have you personally tried? I was actually talking about this with your Torah Talk co-host the other day. We were talking about whether you should get into stand-up comedy.
Me?
Yeah. Why don't you go? Like you live in LA. Why don't you go perform at the Laugh Factory?
Yeah. It you know, it takes a lot of energy, and so if I was to pursue that, you know, a lot of my blogging and other things would have to go by the wayside. So I choose to concentrate my energy on my blogging, on the issues that I see as important and that most other people are not talking about. So that's more important to me than my career or success. Or, you know, I chose about a year ago, about 18 months ago, is to give up my dreams of success and to simply write without view of consequence. And, you know, once I started writing, as I've been writing for the past year or so, you know, you have to give up all illusions of having a mainstream career or having success or honor in the wider world. There would be nothing but obloquy and disgust and humiliation directed towards me because of the things I've been writing about for the past year.
This other post I'm looking at, this is from May 12th, called The Fruits of Feminism.
Yeah, I don't remember that post, but you know, I'm definitely a big fan of traditional roles for men and women, and feminism has kind of destroyed that and destroyed the traditional way that men and women related and bonded and got married. I would like to see that women be required to get married and have a child before they can go to graduate school. What's happening is that our wider society is in a dysgenic death spiral where we're getting steadily stupider every year. Our median IQ is dropping in large part because we've got this, you know, huge influx of low IQ Hispanic immigrants. And then the other reason is that it's the low IQ Americans who are having the most kids, and the high IQ Americans, such as feminists, are going to graduate school and they're having very few children. So I think we have to find a way to make sure that low IQ people stop having kids and that high IQ people are encouraged to have kids so that society can prosper.
I think you I have the memorization of every the IQ of every single group in the world.
Thank you very much, but there's no more useful tool for understanding how the world works than average IQ. If you just correlate a country's average IQ correlates 70% with GNP, and it will tell you, you know, what's possible for a person if you give them a Raven's matrices test at age 7 and you get their IQ, you can find out then whether they're capable of going to college, whether they're capable of being a doctor or lawyer, or if they're going to need a tremendous amount of supervision for the rest of their lives. So,
Do most narcissists have high IQs?
I don't know. I don't know how you could be a narcissist if you had a below average IQ, because you'd have constant experience of other people being smarter than you. So, you know, I don't know how that would work. I think if you had like an average, you know, let's say you had a 95 IQ, which is 5 points below average, you still have a sense, like the cop protagonist in Tom Wolfe's recent novel, Back to Blood, you still have this sense that, you know, other people were seeing all sorts of things that you didn't see, that other people were smarter than you. And it would be, it seems to me, it'd be very hard to develop narcissistic personality disorder with the realization that you have a below average intelligence. But on the other hand, black teenage males have the highest, you know, self-esteem of any group. And, you know, blacks in America have an average IQ of 85. So, you know, blacks in general have a much higher self-esteem than do whites, and whites in general have a higher self-esteem than do Asians, even though whites have a lower IQ on average than Asians. So I guess the answer is I don't know, because, you know, Asians commit suicide at a much higher rate than whites, and whites commit suicide at a much higher rate than blacks. So, you know, whites and Asians seem to like to feel bad about themselves. So I guess I don't know the answer to your question.
So, Luke Ford, I would like to thank you for being on.
Yeah, thanks, Robert.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back for you next time.